Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 239, I have the pleasure of being joined by Drs. Priya Vakharia and Yoshi Yonakawa for a journal club. We cover five recent publications, four in major ophthalmology journals, and one from JAMA. First, we discuss a randomized clinical trial looking at face-down positioning for macular holes. We also have an accompanying editorial on face-down positioning for macular holes, and we join the debate to see how this trial results influences our practice patterns and what we all do in our own practices. Next, we move on to discussion of outcomes of pseudophakic retinal detachments with different surgery modalities, including vitrectomy and buccal vitrectomy. There's a great article reviewing on COVID-19's impact in New York City, put together by the residency program directors there. And we'll end with an interesting essay from JAMA about mentoring millennials. Remember that a list of financial disclosures that are relevant can be found in the episode description. There is also information on how to claim CME credits. You can claim those credits via the link in the episode description that will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website where you can claim CME. Remember two upcoming events. First, VidBuccal Society 8, the virtual series returns with part 2, Vitrectomy in the Wild. This will feature talks on the evolution and practice patterns during COVID-19, the latest developments in the treatment for mild diabetic macular edema, pearls on scleral buckling, and end with really the crown jewel of the VBS meeting annually, the robust surgical complications video session, which will be about 45 minutes and feature several complications video with a panel discussion. That meeting will be Wednesday, June 24th via Zoom at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Registration is free. And there is a link in the episode description to get you to that website to join that meeting. There is also an upcoming ophthalmic trauma competition and discussion that will be June 20th at 11 Eastern. That's hosted by Johns Hopkins University. There is also a link in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two of our colleagues from around the country. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Priya Vakharia from Washington, D.C., Priya, welcome.
Thanks, Jay.
I think it's the first time I've gotten your name correct in maybe 16 attempts, but I'm going to brush my shoulders off and introduce Dr. Yoshi Yonakawa from Philadelphia. Yoshi, welcome back.
Thank you. It's an honor. Good job with my name.
I try. The second half makes it challenging, so I try to keep it to two syllables for most people. So we are going to do a traditional journal club where we discuss five articles in recent journals, mostly in major ophthalmology journals, though the last article was actually published in JAMA. Five is a little more than what we usually do, but as you'll see, a couple of the articles are tied together. So the first article we are going to discuss, Priya's going to tell us a little bit about, but the title of this article, which was published in JAMA Ophthalmology, was Face Down Positioning Following Surgery for a Large Full Thickness Macular Hole, a Multi-Center Randomized Clinical Trial by PASU et al. As part of the PIMS study group, the Positioning and Macular Hole Surgery study group. So Priya, tell us a little bit about this study, how it was designed, and then what the results showed.
Yeah, definitely, Jay. So this was a randomized superiority trial that was conducted in the United Kingdom. There were two parallel groups that were randomized one-to-one of either face-down positioning after macular hole surgery versus face-forward positioning. And so, as I said, this was a randomized trial stratified to one of these two groups. And the participants that were included were patients who had a full-thickness macular hole of at least 400 microns and a duration of hole fewer than 12 months. And all of the patients had a vitrectomy surgery with ILM peel and then a C3F8 gas with or without simultaneous cataract surgery. And following the surgery, these patients were randomized for either face down or face forward positioning for 8 hours per day. These 8 hours could be consecutive or they could be non-consecutive, but they asked them to position for 5 days total. And basically what this study was looking at is a primary outcome of macular hole closure rate, but the secondary outcome measure was visual acuity, and this was measured at 3 months post-op. So in this study, there was a total of 185 participants, and macular hole closure rate was observed in 85.6% of patients who were positioning face forward versus 95.5% of patients who were positioning face down. Now, that was not statistically significant in this superiority trial. They did find that the number needed to treat was about 24 with an adjusted odds ratio of 3.15. Now, in looking at the secondary outcome measure, they found that the improvement in best-corrected visual acuity was about 0.34 logMAR in the face-forward group and 0.57 logMAR in the face-down group. Now, this was statistically significant or trending towards that direction. They also did a visual function questionnaire to see if there was any difference in terms of subjective visual outcomes between these two groups, and there was no significant difference with a p-value of 0.41. And so in this superiority trial, the results of this, per the authors, do not prove that face-down positioning is more likely to close large macular holes compared with face-forward, but it does support a possible conclusion that visual acuity outcomes may be superior in patients who do face-down positioning.
Excellent summary, and I have several top thoughts. I'm sure Yoshi does too, but this is where we're going to bring in our second article, which was an editorial written by colleagues here at Bascom Palmer, or more of a titled invited commentary, but about this article by Dr. Bill Smitty, Harry Flynn, and Liz Vanner, who is one of our statisticians here. And they brought up some issues that we're going to talk about, where they essentially said there are some limitations to this study, that there was no non-inferiority evaluation, that these holes, while large, quote-unquote, greater than 400 microns, were not the largest holes. Perhaps the duration of face-down positioning was not the same as what most clinicians are advising, and whether a 10% difference is actually not statistically significant. And we'll go into the stats and how they kind of did that as well, Yoshi, in a second. They did kind of leave some of this. We don't understand some things about macular hole closure, and they kind of said that the big thing is you can't just say from this study that face-down positioning is unnecessary, which I think we would agree with. I think that's still a smaller study with some limitations. But Yoshi, your reactions when you read this study, bring in your thoughts on the editorial and any other things that you thought of when reading this way it was designed.
Yeah, I really like the study, and surgical studies in general are very difficult to do, but macular hole surgery is one where you can control for a lot of variables. And have a couple of thoughts. The overall conclusion was that they couldn't show that face-down positioning has better macular hole closure rates. But my personal take was that the face-down positioning resulted in like 96% macular hole closure rate. That's better than 86%. And right now, we're, as a community, so good at closing macular holes, I think that personal expectation is having over 90% closure rates. And as surgeons, we strive for 100%, so we're kind of thinking of whatever we can do to increase the rate. And a p-value of 0.08 means that the power just probably wasn't studied enough. The study wasn't powered enough. But this also tells me that for patients who may have trouble positioning, face forward position can still give you very good results. And I think 86% is very respectable. And I think a lot of patients will actually take those odds over face down positioning, like patients with cervical issues or body habitus where you physically can't do face down. And regarding a criticism about the study, that's I personally would have preferred to design a study only for pseudophakic patients, but that's really personal because I do offer a face forward position for my patients if they're pseudophakic. And my rationale, it's not really proven, but I think, you won't get more progression of the cataract, but more importantly, I think you get a better gas fill if you're pseudophakic. And right. For phakic eyes, you just can't remove all the gel for a really good fill, but you can for pseudophakics. And I think in this study, there were a few more patients who were phakic in the face forward arm, and they don't do a subgroup analysis of phakic versus pseudophakic, at least in this paper, and those who had simultaneous cataract surgery, something we don't really do in the U.S., but a lot of patients did in this study. So I would love to know if there was a difference.
Yeah, and Yoshi, a couple other things that I would say that I think the pseudophakic-phakic comment is very astute. I do think that there's some evidence that you do get a better fill in a pseudophakic patient than a phakic patient. I think that the ILM, people debate about whether how widely you peel matters for these holes. And I think for larger holes, people tend to err on the side of a wider peel. We've seen studies, for example, from Japan talking about peeling arcade to arcade. how many disc diameters around a hole do you need to peel the ILM? Here, they didn't really define that unless you guys saw that. I was kind of looking through and I didn't see how they defined that. They kept it to a pretty short method section. I think using C3F8, you know, I think many of us are inclined to use C3F8 gas for these chronic holes. That may make positioning less important. There may be people who prefer not to use C3F8 gas, especially in phakic patients. For whatever reason, they may prefer to use SF6 with strict positioning to maximize contact between the gas interface and the hole, if we do think that's what's helping close these holes. And I think the other thing was, if you look at how they designed, you were talking about the powering, they powered the study to detect a difference of 15%. They said that it wouldn't be recommended to do face down positioning unless the difference was 15%. They said that was clinical consensus. That's kind of an arbitrary number that was chosen here. I mean, one person's 15% difference, there may be people out there who a 5% difference is enough for them to change their behavior. So it's just important to understand the study in the context of that. Yes, it didn't show any difference, but that's because they powered the study for a 15% difference purposefully, because in their eyes, anything less than a 15% difference meant that the positioning maybe is not as critical. So I think it's just important as you, as an individual clinician, to think about that and file that away. Priya, any other comments or thoughts?
You know, I'll just echo what Yoshi said. I think the biggest attribute of the study is that it's reassuring that there's an 86% closure rate without positioning. I think that's, you know, the biggest takeaway from this study is that if you have a patient who can't face down position and can only face forward position, this should provide some confidence that that surgery may be adequately successful despite face down positioning.
You know, Jay, in response to your comment about the 15% set arbitrarily, I think one thing that was really cool that the investigators did here was ask the patients. They asked, given what you know now with the study results, would you still have the surgery? Would you do face down positioning? And I think the patient, the layperson's advisory board preferred going with still the surgery that had the higher success rate so that they can avoid second surgeries. And so I think patient-centered questions are going to be important also.
I think that's super important, because if the hole does not close, I mean, so I think it's one thing to have study results and one thing to have conversations with patients. We were having a similar conversation offline about retinal detachment success rate, for example. We're going to get into that with one of the other studies, so we can talk more about that. But it's interesting to think from a patient perspective. I think most patients I find are more inclined to have less surgeries and do more during that surgery than to do less, maybe have a quote unquote lower risk profile or difficulty, and then maybe increase slightly the risk of a second surgery. So I think you have to have that conversation and understand your patient, because, you know, a patient may be unhappy that they have to go back for a second surgery and be like, well, I would have done face down if you had told me that there was a benefit. So that's a great point, Yoshi, about the patient part of it. And, you know, moving on to our second article, this ties in really nicely. Yoshi, you were part of this group that published the PRO study, and there's been multiple reports from the PRO study, which is the primary retinal detachment outcome study. We did one of the outcomes, I believe, for phakic retinal detachments on one of our previous journal clubs. And now we have the pseudophakic data. And this was written up by Daniel Joseph with Carl Rogillo as the senior author. Yoshi, brief summary for those who aren't aware about the PRO study, but let's keep it brief for those who heard about the PRO study last time and know a little bit about it. And then let's go into this, really the results of this study and what it showed for pseudophakic primary retinal detachment.
Yep. So the PRO study, that's PRO, it's a multi-center study of over 2,600 primary retinal detachment surgeries from six centers. And the study is spearheaded by Ed Ryan of Vitreoretinal Surgery in Minnesota. And we did this because prospective studies for retinal detachments, for it to be properly powered, it's really difficult and time-consuming, and especially for retinal detachment studies, and especially if you also want to answer multiple questions, which is one of our goals. And so we designed a cohort study with really detailed data collection of over 250 for every surgery. And we've published the methodology and overall data recently, where we described that about half the patients underwent primary vitrectomy, about a third buccal vit, and the rest primary buccal. And overall, single surgery success rates were the highest for primary buccals and buccal vits. And in the paper that we discussed previously on this podcast, which was published in Ophthalmology also, we looked at the phakic subsets. And in that study, we showed that in phakic patients with moderate complexity detachments, buccals and buccal vits had better single surgery success rates than primary vitrectomy. And in the current study that we're discussing, we're taking a deeper dive in looking at only the pseudophakic patients. And Dan from St. Louis Retina took the lead in writing this paper. And in the study, we had over 1,000 pseudophakic patients with primary retinal detachments. And we compared the single success anatomic, single surgery anatomic success rates between primary vit and buccal vit. And only a few patients underwent primary buckling, but we excluded those patients. We also excluded patients with PVR, because that would be skewed towards buccal vits, was our assumption. And in this study, about 75% of patients underwent primary vitrectomy, and a quarter underwent buccal vits. And the knee-jerk reaction, I think, usually for pseudophakic patients these days is primary vitrectomy. You don't need a buccal for a number of reasons, like you can shave really well, you don't want to cause the myopic shift in the eye. But we had a good number of those patients, over 200, who had buccal vits. And so the result was that the single surgery anatomic success in primary vitrectomy was 84%, and in buccal vits, it was 92%. And that was a statistically significant difference. And it was interesting because the buccal vit arm had tougher cases also, like younger patients, more MAC off, worse preoperative visual acuity, more inferior detachments. The caveat here is that there was no difference in final visual acuity, though. And overall, both arms did great. Final visual outcome was around 2040 to 2050. And we did this because, you know, the last major retinal detachment study was the SPR study that was 20 years ago, where they showed that primary buccals had better visual outcomes in phakic patients. Primary vitrectomy had better anatomic outcomes in pseudophakic eyes. But in that study, about half of the patients in the vitrectomy arm also underwent buccal vits, so it's really unclear whether that was an added benefit or not. Plus, that was before the era of small gauge surgery. And so basically, the take-home point was that buccals still have a role, even in pseudophakic detachments. And I think we'll continue to have individualized treatment because every surgeon thinks that their way is the best. But hopefully, I'm hoping that this study provides additional data and confidence in our decisions.
Priya, after that wonderful summary and this wonderful article, I don't have a ton to add, but your comments or thoughts on the results of the study?
Yeah, I'll say this, the results of this study actually kind of blew me away. I'm one of those surgeons that really does just primary vitrectomy for pseudophakic detachments, and I'm definitely going to consider buccals more likely. I did have a question for Yoshi. I know I didn't see here in the study any mention of 360 laser. For patients who didn't get a buccal, did they maybe were they less likely to get 360 laser? Is it possible that patients with primary vitrectomy detached more frequently because of missed breaks, and maybe the buccal is adding some additional support for missed breaks? Is that potentially why, or is that not a factor?
That's a great point. The first Crow paper that was actually studied, published, looked at this question. And this was one that Jay Wang, a fellow at Mass Eye and Ear currently, we did this study when I was in Boston, looking at 360 laser or not in buccal vits and primary vitrectomies. And the single surgery anatomic success was not different between 360 laser, but when patients detached, then outcomes were worse in patients who received 360. And so there's a lot of possibilities of why that happens, but one thought is that 360 laser can cause more PVR potentially. But regarding your specific question for which patients received 360 laser and why and how they failed, the study is not able to answer that specific question of why and how patients re-detached.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And I think I'll tell you from experience, I did a case today. I tend to be like Priya, where pseudophakes, I generally don't buckle. I will put a buckle on some pseudophakes, but I think it's really hard, Yoshi. There's a lot of clinical judgment that goes in. But sometimes you examine a patient pre-op, and pseudophakic examinations in the clinic, at least in my hands, don't tend to be as reliable in terms of detecting some of the small breaks that you'll find in pseudophakic eyes. And you may see a single break, and it might seem like overkill to put a buckle, and then you get in the OR, and then you find an abnormal vitreous space, you find a posterior insertion, and then it becomes a decision making, do you add a buckle or not at the time of vitrectomy, which is doable, but is technically a little difficult. I think not every vitrectomy is created equal to, and that's been one of the arguments for people against this study, is it's retrospective, and some surgeons do a much more meticulous shave, some surgeons, like Bri was mentioning, may do more laser. Some surgeons treat the area of pathology. Some surgeons treat just the area of retinal detachment. And we don't know if any of these things, even shaving, really influences the rate of redetachment, either from a secondary break or from proliferative vitreoretinopathy. So I think it's great to have more data points. I think this is helpful. For me, at least, what I do typically is, if I have a pseudophakic detachment that does not repair with a vitrectomy, I usually add a buckle the second surgery, unless it's very clear that there's going to be a large inferior retinectomy. And even in those cases, I tend to kind of throw the kitchen sink and do an encircling band. But again, the science behind what I do, similar to the science what other people do, is so mixed because the data out there is so mixed. And so it really becomes nuanced. And I think it's part of the challenge for the fellows and residents listening who are wondering how they're going to structure their practice patterns. Part of the challenge of structuring your practice patterns as a retina specialist is everyone kind of does something a little bit different. And we do base it on data, so it's not like people are making arbitrary decisions, but the data says different things. So I think, again, this is fascinating, at least backs up the times when we do buckles, kind of the thought process behind putting a buckle in these eyes.
Yeah, and I'll say one other thing, Jay. I think similar to the last study that we were talking about, this also highlights the importance of talking to a patient and discussing their options, because I'll tell you that I have some pseudophakic patients who would be very upset if they had a refractive change and would rather just do a vitrectomy, even if the success rate is lower, on the off chance that maybe they don't have to become glasses dependent or wear contact lens or do something like that after. So I think that that's also important to keep in mind, that these are also individualized treatments for patients.
Yoshi, any other comments before we move on?
Yeah, I think the patient factor is huge. I think the surgeon factor, like you mentioned, Jay, is important also. And that's actually a question that we're trying to answer with the database now in a future publication.
Awesome. Looking forward to that data. Well, the next paper we're going to talk about is Living with COVID-19, a perspective from New York Area Ophthalmology Residency Program Directors at the epicenter of the pandemic. Royce Chen was the primary author, but really all the authors here are different leaders of programs in the New York City and greater New York City area. And this was just essentially a very short report about what happened in New York with COVID-19. Obviously, New York was very hard hit starting in March 2020, and we're recording this end of May 2020. And it's interesting how this pandemic really brought a lot of these programs together. They developed these protocols with different teams of residents, different teams for inpatient responsibilities such as consultations or inpatient consults, separated them from other residents who did outpatient clinics. They talked about how to quarantine residents who may develop COVID-19 symptoms or tested positive for COVID-19. They had to deal with PPE shortages. They talked about pooling lectures in order to make sure that their residents could get adequate education during this time, even in a socially distant manner. And kind of the progression was, by the end of March into mid-April, a lot of these residents, trainees, and faculty members have been redeployed in many instances, not just into primary care settings, but many into COVID units or ICU floors. So the kind of the take home is there's some big things that have kind of come in with COVID-19 that we've talked about before. Teleophthalmology has become a bigger deal in New York, was absolutely critical for them to be able to take care of their patients. How to structure clinics, pooling their curriculum together and banding together may be something that's permanent going forward. So it's really interesting, and it's kind of a microcosm of everything that's happened globally with COVID-19 in ophthalmology, and not just in the way we practice, but in the way we educate each other. You know, Yoshi, you read this article by Royce, who did a wonderful job putting this together. It was really well written and really insightful. Anything else that comes to mind when you read this? I really think the most powerful thing to me is the pooling kind of the curriculum long term, I think, is going to be such a boon, meaning that if you train in a New York program, who's to say that you don't get education from faculty across the city? And honestly, in today's world, with the democratization of the internet and technology, you can get education from anywhere, from any program.
So this was a phenomenal piece. I really liked it. And I'm not a big social media person by any means, but this is a piece that I shared. I think it's beautifully written, and you can sense and feel the emotion of the doctors who wrote this. And so huge kudos and shout out to all of our colleagues in epicenters like New York City. And I think a lot of the New York City experience reverberates throughout the rest of the country also. And so this was a really important opinion and scientific piece. I loved how the program directors ended by saying that they're extremely proud of our residents. And I feel that way about all of our trainees also. They're sacrificing so much and delivering really good, passionate care to those in need. So just bravo to all the students and residents and fellows on the podcast.
Priya, any other thoughts?
I think this piece kind of embodies that quote that everyone's talking about now, which is that, in every crisis, there's an opportunity. And in this correspondence, they discuss how a lot of them had didactics that perhaps had just been passed down from year to year. But during the COVID pandemic, everyone across the country has had to revamp the way that they approach things. And I think that, they talk about how this actually might be a better way to do it in the future. And so I do like how they shine a little bit of positive light on what otherwise is a very difficult situation, especially in New York. And I think that this piece embodies that.
I think that that's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful way to kind of view this. And I think that we've seen so many wonderful kind of steps forward in terms of, like you said, people coming in a crisis and great things coming from it. And that kind of ties into the last thing we're going to talk about. This is a article from JAMA by Jennifer Walji. She wrote an opinion. This is JAMA, not JAMA Ophthalmology. It was titled Mentoring Millennials. And I would guess that all three of us technically qualify as millennials based on the definition, people born between 1980 and 2000, though millennial kind of carries a different connotation in some instances where it means a certain sort of approach to life and to work. So this just talks about the different sort of examples, it goes through different examples of how millennials can miscommunicate with people of different generations. I think we've all kind of encountered this as mentors, maybe, or Priya, when you were chief resident, or Yoshi and I, when we were fellows, we've kind of interacted with people and had sort of these interactions. So given that we are millennials technically, but we're kind of the bridge between an older generation and a newer generation, because I think doctors tend to lag generationally behind, given the conservatism of medicine. What did you think about this, Priya, when you read this? I mean, I do think that it's a tough balance because we really need to tailor to how people best learn, how they approach life. But there is some value in my mind to some of the traditionalism in medicine. For example, the type of communications that are used with certain individuals in your academic department, which was one of the examples, or when is an appropriate time, for example, to go into someone's office to ask a question. So how do you kind of approach this as kind of an old soul in a new world?
Yeah, absolutely, Jay. Well, first, in reading this article, I was kind of disheartened that there's an article written about us about how to cope with millennials. but, I guess in reading the article, it makes sense. And I try to think of our older mentors and perhaps how they've been frustrated with some of our behaviors and similarly us, how we get frustrated with other younger behaviors. I think that, the biggest takeaway from this piece is that there are different ways to approach learning. And I think that the biggest thing is they have a table in here, which kind of shows how some actions can be misconstrued from millennials. Instead of entitlement, it's more about people trying to become and how millennials to be involved, and they don't really understand the hierarchical structure. I think the biggest thing that this article sheds to light is actually putting down in words what we all perceive and experience in day to day, and actually gives us a structure to define it. And only once you define an issue that may be bothering you can you actually tackle it to help. And so I think that was one of the biggest things here. And, they go through different strategies to help in mentoring millennials, such as, being more available for shorter increments of time. Millennials are very used to having information on hand at all times. You have, the internet at your fingertips. You can basically, you kind of want immediate information dissemination, and so kind of have strategies on how to mentor in that similar fashion, to be available in abbreviated time intervals rather than to structure a one time per week to mentor. And then it also talks about allowing younger individuals to be more involved, to empower them, and to really capitalize on individual strengths. But I think the biggest thing in this piece is that it just defines what some of our older mentors may be frustrated by, and again, give strategies to tackle that.
Yoshi, what do you think?
So whenever I read articles about millennials, I have to look it up, like, am I a millennial or not? Because I really straddle the two generations. I think we all do that. So just for the listeners, I looked it up, and the paper actually defines it also as millennials being born between 1980 to 2000, which is about half of the current workforce. And an interesting term that I looked up that I think all three of us, I think, fall in, and a lot of listeners, I believe, are the people that straddle 5 years before and after 1950, so 1975 to 1985. I don't know how to pronounce it. I think it's Xennials, like combination of Generation X and Millennials. And just FYI, after Millennials, it's Generation Z and then Generation Alpha. I really liked how the article started with the scene at the scrub sink, and I really encourage everybody listening to just access this two-page piece. But it's an attending resident and student, and as the attending is scrubbing, the med student is kind of lingering behind, tapping away at the cell phone, and the attending gets really annoyed, but the student's actually looking up information. And when the attending pimps the student in, you know, baby boomer Generation X style, the student answers the question really thoroughly and then shows the attending a video on the phone, like, hey, can I get your thoughts on this technique? And so I thought that was really a very representative moment that we can all relate to. And I really like this paper because it wasn't just characterizing how our millennials like, but it provided actionable items of how we can embrace the positive aspects of the generational differences. So it was a very philosophical piece, and I think it's about trying to look for the positive side of things, and that generation differences exist and they can't be avoided or changed. But I think that the core values remain, whether it's, you know, being compassionate, being truthful, working hard, none of that's really changed, but it's just adjusting how these values are taught.
Yeah, and I think that the phone example, like you said, is such a classic one, right? I think that, but it's also, it goes both ways though, Yoshi. I think that sometimes they are looking something up, and sometimes, like any of us, you think you're going to start looking something up, and the next thing you know, you're going down the rabbit hole on Twitter or whatever, Instagram or whatever social media application you use, and you completely lost track of what you're supposed to be looking at. The distraction factor is there. I mean, I'm going to tell a very millennial story. You know, we'll tie this in at the end. I'm trying to kind of tie it back and forth between this very stream of consciousness podcast. But step 2CS, the clinical sales portion, was announced in this week that it is now at least temporarily on hold for 12 to 18 months, which I think is phenomenal. That's the exam where you would have to fly to a city and take an exam if on a standardized patient in a different city. There were only a handful of cities that were offered. It was an expensive venture. You paid a lot of money. They gave you a really nice lunch with snacks, as we were talking about that earlier. It was definitely not worth the over $1,000 you paid for that lunch and the snacks. And maybe I'm a millennial, but I'm glad that that's gone. I thought that was an unnecessary expense. I thought that was unnecessary travel. I thought it didn't show much. I still have slight feigned bitterness over my step 2 CS score, and I am very glad that it is gone. So that is my millennial moment for the evening.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, Jay. I even think for the oral boards for ophthalmology, I mean, they're definitely not going away, but now they're doing a more, or looking into a more virtual format. And I actually wonder if all of these in-person examinations are going to become virtual after this. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the next 5-10 years.
So my final step 2CS story, I took step 2CS the day after the Super Bowl, which was poor planning by me. So I watched the Super Bowl with my classmate who did not care about football at all. So this person did not care the Super Bowl that night. So I watched it in a hotel room in Atlanta while eating really, really bad French fries. And then took my step 2CS the next day. and scored below average English proficiency, which was great, which is a great, great feeling.
So funny.
Yeah, it's a good story. That used to be, at some point in my career, that was one of my favorite pickup lines when I was describing my medical career. It no longer works, but and there was a point where that held traction.
I barely remember step two CS, man. It feels like such a long time ago. I just remember that there was one ophthalmology-related question, and I was so happy, but I doubt I got it right.
I honestly can't even remember. I can't even remember taking CS. All I remember was that it was in the same town that I did med school in, so I was pumped. I just walked down the street and took it. But I can see how annoying it would be to fly somewhere.
Yeah, not everyone was as fortunate or as lucky. Well, Priya Shokaria, Yoshi Onakawa, thanks so much for joining. It's a great journal club, and I look forward to catching up with you guys soon.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks, Jay. Have a good night.
Take care, guys. Bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 239 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You can also click on the link to get subscribe to our email list. That'll give you updates on the most recent episodes. You can also subscribe on your mobile device. On my iPhone, for example, I use the Apple Podcast app. That gives me updates on the most recent episodes. We're on Facebook and on Twitter, and you can reach out to us at any point by emailing us at retinapodcast@gmail.com or by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website. Thank you to Drs. Vakaria and Onakawa for joining me for this Journal Club episode. Thank you to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Mike Vinicasa for putting together this episode and all the accompanying social media. Thank you, listeners, for what you do, the patients you take care of, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. I'm recording this. This is on today on June 2nd, 2020. This episode will be coming out June 8th. It's been a super tumultuous time in the United States. We've seen, beyond COVID-19, many of the protests related to the death of George Floyd, and this is not a political podcast, but I think we can all agree that one of the things we can continue to do as a field and as a community is continue to respect each other, love each other, show respect for people of all backgrounds, all genders, all income statuses, really kind of universally apply the same principles we apply to the healthcare we deliver, apply in terms of the respect we deliver to each other, and continue to model for the rest of the country and move towards a better tomorrow, because clearly, you know, there's still so much work to be done in terms of greater equity and greater sort of happiness and respect in our country. And we have the power to do it. And it's just amazing to always see the great achievements and things we're able to do together as a community. And if we can also show that solidarity and improve our respect for diversity as we go forward in the future, that will go a long way. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.